I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today, our guest is Dr. Glenn Thackery, professor of geosciences at Idaho State University. We're talking about the Great Bonneville Flood today. It's one of the most amazing prehistoric events ever to happen in Idaho, so this is going to be a lot of fun. Been looking forward to doing this for a while.
Every day I go to the zoo, I get a look over into the results of the late Bonneville Flood.
Well, when you live in Pocatello, Chubbuck, signs are everywhere.
You cannot miss it.
In fact, there are a lot of unexplainable things lying around that make a lot of sense when you realize a lot of water moved through here.
A lot of water.
We're going to get to that later on, but you know what? First, let's talk about some nature news.
All right. This is really kind of fun, right up my alley. We've got a researcher. She has noticed that the Visayan warty pig from the Philippines, it's an endangered hog, critically endangered hog. She has noticed that they have been using tools.
She spends a lot of time with the hogs.
Luckily for her, she was at a zoo in France, and she noticed that this warty hog family were digging holes, and they were picking up pieces of bark and using the bark, manipulating it in their mouth to help dig these holes. Which is really cool. But with her observations, she kind of had to caution, and she's correct. These animals were in a captive situation, and behaviors at times will change because they're in captivity. But it was very obvious that they were using these pieces of barks as tools, and they believe that the mother of the piglets figured out how to use the bark, and she has in turn taught her family members how to use bark to dig holes.
I love this. This is a good story.
It's awesome. And she kind of went out because these guys are critically endangered. It's really kind of hard to get some good research in the wild. But she has, with this not-for-profit conservation group, she has gotten some anecdotal examples of these warty pigs using tools too. One of the things that they do is when they come up to civilization and electric fences, they'll toss or push rocks into the electric fence. And if there's a popping noise, they know it's on.
I love it.
And they avoid it. And if there's no popping noise, then they'll move right through it.
Okay, so what do we take away from this? Pigs are smart.
Smarter than we might have thought.
And maybe we underestimate.
Okay. And thank goodness they don't have thumbs.
I could go on that one, but I won't. Okay, so we like to start off the show with some trivia, and today we're talking about Bonneville Flood. Bonneville Flood, you're going to hear lots about. Well, our question is, what Great Lake has the same volume of water that flowed during the Bonneville Flood? You will be amazed and impressed when you learn this answer. But first, we got to take a break. We'll see you after.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Dr. Glenn Thackery. He's professor of geosciences at Idaho State University and recently was awarded fellow of the Geological Society of America. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And welcome. And thank you for being here on Nature of Idaho.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Good to be here and talk about one of the big events of Southeast Idaho.
Well, so tell us a little bit about yourself. What kind of a geoscientist are you?
I am a geoscientist who works mainly on processes near the Earth's surface and at the Earth's surface. So I study rivers and landslides, especially glaciers, and evidence of earthquake faulting, and try to make sense of how the geologic history is and how it might impact us.
Wonderful. It's sort of detective work, isn't it? Piecing together bits and pieces of evidence and telling a story that maybe forecasts how things will happen in the future.
Yeah, that's right. And the trickiest part of that is earthquakes. You can collect all the data you want, and it's going to happen when it's going to happen.
That's right. Very good. Well, so today we're going to talk about this Bonneville flood, and folks who live in southeast Idaho, most of the people that I encounter have a familiarity at least with that term, about the idea of Lake Bonneville. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about what Lake Bonneville was? What do we know?
Yeah, well, Lake Bonneville existed during the last ice age and previous ice ages. And at its greatest extent, it covered about half of Utah, the western half of Utah. All of those basins were filled at least partly with water. The mountain ranges would have been islands in the lake basin, surrounded by water. And it occurred during the ice ages, not because a lot of glaciers were melting and dumping into the Great Basin, but because the precipitation was higher and it was cooler, so there was less evaporation. Maybe 50 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer was what it was, and so there just wasn't as much evaporation as there is now. So you add more water and you subtract less water and you get a big lake.
So we're imagining a lake that's roughly half the size of Utah, relatively shallow, I presume?
Shallow in many areas, but around Salt Lake City, for example, where we can see the lake benches above the city on the Wasatch Front, it was several hundred feet deep.
Right.
And in some of the higher basins, it would have been shallower. So pretty deep.
And so today, of course, we have Great Salt Lake, which is located, in the low spot of what was Lake Bonneville. And this leads to maybe the largest misconception I hear, or maybe misunderstanding is a better word. Great Salt Lake, we know, is a very, very salty body of water. And how does it relate to Lake Bonneville, which we believe was completely fresh water?
Right. So Lake Bonneville would have been fed by rainfall, snowmelt, and all the rivers of the Great Basin dumping their water into it. And that would all be fresh water. And then after the Bonneville flood was done, there was still a lot of lake there. Lake was still fairly large. And for the rest of that water to go away and leave only the Great Salt Lake, there had to be a lot of evaporation. And so the water evaporated away, and anything dissolved in that water was left behind. And that's where the salt of the Great Salt Lake and the Bonneville Salt Flats comes
right.
from.
Right. So it's a concentration of salts from a very large body of water, evaporating it down to a small body of water, relatively speaking, and just concentrating all of those salts into ever more concentrated levels into the current.
That's right. That's right. And we think of Lake Bonneville as having been pretty fresh water, but all it takes is a lot of evaporation and that salt, instead of getting out to the ocean, gets dropped there.
Right. And so the other notion that I hear often with Lake Bonneville is, was it ever connected to the ocean, to the Pacific Ocean, that is?
Right. Well, except only during the Bonneville flood was it connected. And other than that, it was an isolated lake basin.
Right.
It didn't flow out anywhere, which is why it could rise.
Right.
And when it was flowing through Pocatello, it was connected into the Snake River system. But that should have been the only time.
As an outflow, not an inflow.
As right. an outflow.
That's right.
Important distinction.
A very important distinction. Okay.
So let's look at that. Now we've kind of got the basics of Lake Bonneville. How did the flood occur?
Well, there are two parts of this puzzle. The lake had never reached the level that it did during the last ice age. And there are a lot of questions about why that was. It never reached the dam down near Preston at Red Rock Pass. Red Rock Pass was the lowest point on the entire edge of the Lake Bonneville Basin, and the lake had never made it up to that level. And then the Bear River was diverted into Lake Bonneville before the last ice age, and that added enough water to cause it to rise to that level. And for a period of time, it probably overflowed as a river. There was a good-sized river probably flowing through Pocatello at the time. But then something happened down at Red Rock Pass near Preston, and that something caused the dam to break. It was a gravel dam on top of old lake sediments. There are active faults in the area, so there may have been an earthquake that shook it loose, or it may be the dam just got saturated, and any dam that gets saturated, gets too much water in it, weakens and then can fall apart. There was a very large landslide at the time that that helped remove that dam, and it was removed very suddenly, and then and that caused the level of the lake to drop 300 feet and all that water to flow through Marsh Valley and Pocatello and onto the Snake River Plain.
Right. So the Lake Bonneville, which again covers much of Utah, a northern arm of it, or a couple arms, actually make it into the southernmost parts of Idaho. And this is where Red Rock Pass is located today, just near Preston.
That's right. And there are other fingers into the raft, the southern extension of the Raft River Valley. But as far as we know, it never overflowed there.
Right.
This was the lowest point.
And so if I drove to Red Rock Pass today, as I've done a few times, what do I see when I'm there?
Well, when you are there, there's a sign and there's a monument on top of a bedrock hill right next to the road. And if you look south from there, you can actually see shorelines of Lake Bonneville, and they're above your head. And if you look north, you can see a high surface about 300 feet above you. That's the gravel fan, the alluvial fan that had stretched across that valley. And so that fan, hundreds of feet above your head, was the dam. And then during the flood, the landslide and then the outflow in the flood dropped that, cut out everything in that open space we see now, and down to a bedrock level where it then stabilized. It couldn't erode down any further at that point.
Wow.
So you can see the old dam in the distance, and you can see the floor of the valley now, and you can see lake shorelines
and,
to the south.
And the vertical distance, you said it, you passed over it, and I want to repeat this. So the vertical span of water that was lost from the high stand of Lake Bonneville to the new lake level after the flood was how many feet?
That was 300 feet. And so if you want to think of the volume of the Bonneville flood, you have to think of half of the state of Utah under 300 feet of water, 300 feet of water over that area draining through Pocatello. And that's why it was such a large flood.
Right. So when you think about, I mean, you've got this massive amount of water. How long did it take? You know, when you think of a flood, you've got this initial massive surge of water. How long was that? How many days, weeks was that initial surge of water?
Mm-hmm. Well, the best estimate is 3 months. And that comes from a geologist named Jim O'Connor, who studied the Bonneville flood in detail in the early 1990s. And he used a model that the Bureau of Reclamation uses to estimate floods if a dam breaks. They have to have those estimates. He used that, and it always takes time for the water to flow north to a dam break, in this case north to Red Rock Pass, and to move out through that valley. And the estimate that came from that study was 3 months. So we can think of 3 months of very high flow.
Wow. 3 months of high flow of 300 vertical feet of water stretching half of Utah coming through the Gate City.
Right.
Right?
So would you be able to estimate, I mean, the speed of that water that was moving through?
Yes. Well, actual speeds are difficult. We could figure that out, but I'm not going to try to do it in my head at this point. But the flow that passed through Pocatello would have been about 20 times the largest flood ever recorded on the Mississippi River at New Orleans, which was the 1927 flood. So 20 times the size of the biggest flood on the Mississippi River flowed through Pocatello for about 3 months.
So this water is flowing, you know, it goes through Red Rock Pass, it gets into the Portneuf River. It's going to flow through the Port Neuf River and has to come from the south northward through the gap, as we call it, in the Gate City here. And the gap is this constriction in the mountains where, I don't know what the diameter is at the narrowest, but it has to get its way through that little bottleneck. So what happens there?
Right. Well, what happens there, it's kind of interesting. Anytime a river goes through a narrow point, the water actually creates its own dam. And so the evidence in the Inkom area is that the water backed up through Inkom and was probably swirling counterclockwise through around Inkom.
Counterclockwise because we're in the northern hemisphere.
because there are piles of boulders on the east side of the basalt flow there, and so there's direct evidence for that. And then so the water would have been pooling back there because it could only get through the gap so fast, and it would have been very steep, very fast. You wouldn't have wanted to be in it in any boat that is on Earth.
Category 6.
Beyond it.
Category do not do.
Do not. Okay, so it gets through the constriction, and then it opens up into our valley.
That's right.
Well, so then what happens there?
Well, it did that again and again. There are places like Red Rock Pass and the Port Neuf Gap, and actually Red Hill as well. Red Hill is kind of a narrow spot in this valley. But wherever it got narrowed, it would have to deepen and move faster. And when it does that, it can erode very, very quickly and carry boulders and gravel and move huge amounts of sediment. And so what happened in the narrow spots like the Port Neuf Gap, like around Red Hill, is that it eroded. But then when the flow could spread out, it drops that load. So the water would have been roaring through it, probably literally roaring through Port Neuf Gap. And as it entered the south end of the valley, which is kind of wide, down by Century High School, it's kind of wide there, it would have spread out and dropped that gravel. And so in the valley floor there, we have the Bonneville flood gravel, which is 200 or 300 feet thick, and is that's the gravel through which our drinking water in the Port Neuf Aquifer flows. And so it dropped that load there and kept moving northward, narrowed down, ripped up a lot of the Port Neuf basalt lava flow that's at Ross Park, and dumped a lot of very large boulders in the Pocatello area.
So large boulders, we're familiar in this area, but for listeners that haven't been to Pocatello area, what are our boulders like here?
Bigger than our heads.
Bigger than our heads, bigger than our cars,
yes.
Some of them.
Yeah.
And so they can be 6 or 8 feet across. There are a lot of boulders that are sitting around as landscaping boulders that are 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet across, and some that are even larger. And down at the zoo, of course, there are some very large rocks.
And they're round.
Yes, they're not jagged or sharp.
That's
they're
right.
round.
They haven't traveled very far, but they are round.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it is the boulders that first got early geologists interested in wondering, you know, how these formed in the first place. Is that where the Bonneville flood story maybe started?
Well, interestingly, G.K. Gilbert started it back in the 1880s or 90s.
Sure.
He studied Lake Bonneville itself and defined a lot of what we know about big inland lakes.
Right.
A brilliant piece of work. And he only came as far north as Red Rock Pass. And he noticed that the lake shorelines are above the level of Red Rock Pass in that area. He noticed it looked like there had been a landslide there. And he said, it looks like Lake Bonneville may have flooded out through this way, or in some fashion he suggested that.
Huh.
And then in the 1950s, a guy named Hal Maldy started putting together the actual geologic evidence for it in terms of the gravel, the large boulders, the gravel bars, and things like that.
Right, and there's also other features, erosive features, I guess, that we can find out there.
Right, and if you go walk around on the basalt flows near Inkom or in the Port Neuf Gap, you can see places where the water has scoured the basalt. We can see places, and probably the edges of the benches in Pocatello were, the edges were probably removed by the Bonneville flood. It really looks like that's the case.
So how far did the effects of the flood reach through Idaho?
Right, a long way. And so at the north end of Pocatello, the flood entered the Snake River Plain, and that was another place where the flow could spread out. We have what's called the Michaud Gravels. It's a geologic unit with a name, and that is a very thick gravel unit. There are gravel pits all over the north end of Pocatello in that, and that's more the size of cobbles and pebbles than boulders out there. And then in various places along the way, we see evidence of it. We see evidence of it wherever the flood exited a canyon, we see big piles of boulders and entire river terraces made of boulders. And one of the places you can see that is on I-84 as you go down the hill toward Glen's Ferry from the east. You can see what are called the melon gravels, which were called melons because they're as big as melons and bigger, and they were called petrified watermelons. And you can see them there. And we can follow that all the way along the Snake River Plain. There's some evidence in Hell's Canyon. And then we lose it up near Lewiston. And there's one final gravel deposit there. And up there, it's a whole different story because it was the Missoula floods up in that area.
That's a long way for all of this water to travel. Where does it go from there? Snake River must connect to the Columbia.
Yeah, would have connected to the Columbia and gone out to the ocean through the Columbia River.
Is there any evidence of that event carried, westward, or is it get diluted? The signal get diluted by that point.
It gets lost there. The Missoula floods that roared across eastern Washington from a glacier dam in northern Idaho. Those floods were so big that they completely reset that landscape. And some of those floods were several thousand years after the Bonneville flood.
Okay.
In fact, most of the floods of at least the last round of Missoula floods were after the Bonneville flood.
Right.
So all evidence has basically been erased from after Lewiston.
Right. And we wouldn't be able to distinguish it there from the Missoula floods because it's the same kind of flood evidence there.
Yeah. Right. Well, so I'm wondering, could you paint a picture for what Pocatello would have been like? And where would you want to observe this, I guess, if you were a person, hanging around? And what age was... Do we have a good constraint on how long ago?
Yeah, we have really good constraint on how long ago, based on some work just a few years ago, okay, by a guy named Will Amid, and he works at a school in the Northeast. And he has some dates of the Bonneville flood from the Incom area 17,500 years ago. And that's a firm age on the actual flood boulders.
Okay.
So that's the best age we have.
17,500 years ago.
That's right.
So if we could get in our time machine, mm-hmm, right, H.G. Wells, and visit 17,500 years ago, and you were in Pocatello, where would you want to be, and what would you observe? What would it be like, do you think?
I've thought of that a lot. Where would I want to be? As long as I knew how high it was going to go, being up at the columns on Red Hill would be a great place to watch it. As long as you knew that it wasn't going to get as high as you, because then it'd be very scary. But beyond that, I'd like to be either up in the eastern hills several hundred feet higher or the western hills. Maybe Kimport Peak would have been a great place to watch it.
Right.
So when we talk about the scouring effect, are we looking at losing a couple of hundred feet of dirt and soil in the Pocatello area? So we wouldn't be as low as we are now. We'd have to... So are we looking at... Was Pocatello more of a flat area, plains-type area prior to the flood?
Probably it was about as low because everything has to obey the level of the Snake River Plain in the Portneuf Valley. And it looks like the Portneuf Valley had been eroded more or less to where it is now. It's hard to tell for sure. But certainly the creeks have cut into the fans, into the west bench, for example, a little bit more since then. And so it really scraped out a lot of gravel and soil from the valley floor, but then it filled it back in so much that it's hard to know exactly where that valley floor was. Probably not too far off of where it is now, though.
That's interesting. So there's a great story about the eye on Red Hill. Could you tell us about the eye on Red Hill?
Right. So the eye on Red Hill is a big orange eye to represent Idaho State. It's right above campus. And the guy I mentioned, Jim O'Connor, who studied the Bonneville Flood back in the 90s, told me, if you want to tell people where the Bonneville Flood was in Pocatello, when they put up the orange eye, they put it in almost exactly the right spot. And the height of the eye was about how closely I know how high it was. Well, the eye disappeared several years ago because it was falling apart. And they just last week, the eye was restored. So the flood level of the Bonneville Flood has been restored on Red Hill now in the form of the orange eye. It's a little bit higher than it should be. But generally, just from the about at the bottom of the eye is the level of the Bonneville Flood.
Wow.
And water moving very fast. It would have been at the peak, it would have been the flow of the Amazon River flowing through Pocatello up to that eye. So it would have been moving very fast.
That's a lot of water.
Wow. Wow. You know, folks that are visiting or that are from our area, what are some basic things that they can be looking for to be able to pick this out? Either for the Bonneville Flood itself, we talked a little bit about that, but also as they're driving into the Salt Lake area and seeing the benches, what should they look for?
Right. So let's start with the evidence of the lake benches in along the Wasatch Front. A few hundred feet above the valley floor, there are flat spots on the mountainsides. And you can tell where they are because there's almost always a gravel pit there, because where the river's discharged into the lake, they dumped a lot of gravel. And so that's where the big gravel pits are that are used to make the concrete to build the Wasatch Front. And so you can see those benches very well. And the highest one of those is the Lake Bonneville, the high Lake Bonneville shoreline. And the next big one down is called the Provo shoreline. And the Bonneville shoreline formed before the flood, the Provo shoreline after the flood. So that distance is the part that drained in the Bonneville flood. And so Red Rock Pass, we've already talked about. In Northern Marsh Valley at the edges of the lava flow, along Marsh Creek especially, you can see boulder bars that stream out from the edge of the lava flow. And in the Portneuf Gap, you can see those in places as well. And then at the zoo at Ross Park, we can see those boulders. And then anytime anybody digs a hole in downtown Pocatello, there's a lot of clinking and clanging and probably bad words because they're having to dig through those Bonneville gravels. And frankly, the upper campus of ISU, the terrace on which Holt Arena and the upper campus building sit, that is a Bonneville flood gravel bar, and that also has a lot of large boulders in it. So we can see those things pretty readily. And then along the Snake River Plain, wherever you see large, rounded gravel boulders, the Mellon gravels, wherever you see those, you know that you're seeing evidence of the Bonneville flood.
That's fantastic. And one of the nice things in our area is some of the geologic history that we have, some of it even recent history, is very observable if you know what to look for and keep your eyes open for it.
That's right. That's right.
Well, so I started the show off with a trivia question about the volume of water that was involved with Lake Bonneville, and it was an awful lot. It's the equivalent of one of our great lakes from the Midwestern part of the country. Can you tell us what Great Lake?
Yeah, it was the Great Lake that near where I grew up in Michigan, and it's Lake Michigan. Which, if you go to Lake Michigan, it's a big lake. You cannot see across
that
Lake Michigan.
That is a giant lake.
It's a giant lake, yeah. And it stretches all the way up to the Mackinac Bridge between the peninsulas of Michigan, all the way up the side of the Mitten, if you look at a map of Michigan. And that's a big mass of water.
Right.
It's impressive.
It's 1,000 cubic miles. A cubic mile. There's 1,000 cubic miles of water in Lake Michigan, and that much water came gushing through Pocatello, which is just mind-blowing.
Phenomenal. There was no water shortage.
There's no water shortage 17,500 years ago.
That's right. Right. And now there's no boulder shortage.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. We want to thank Dr. Glenn Thackery for joining us today. And to learn more about the Bonneville flood, please Google ISU's Idaho State University's Digital Atlas of Idaho. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.